Okay, so I'm going to talk to you today about some, mostly some new experimental results we've got that are showing some, as the title says, dramatic reductions in friction at earthquake slip rates. And I want to point out at the beginning that a number of people have given me data that I put in these slides, but in particular I want to emphasize David Goldsby, who was here last week, who's actually done most of the real work and the experiments and that I'm going to be talking about here. So the main point I want to bring out is that there are many potential slip high-speed weakening mechanisms, and they all may give low friction at seismic slip rates, and I'll go through that. But the background is that at low slip rates, less than a millimeter a second, where most of the data exists, coefficient of friction is relatively high, 0.6 to 0.8, which we all in this area tend to know as Byerly's law. And in, we'll come back to this at the end of the talk. Byerly's law is coefficient of friction of rocks is 0.6, crudely put. Okay. I mean, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but that's basically it. And it's come to be known as Byerly's law, even though it was known by a lot of people before that, but that's kind of, that's the jargon. Measurements of stress in the Earth in the upper crust, which don't go all that deep, but go down to moderately good depths in some of the South African mines, suggest that the stress that the stresses are kind of bounded by Byerly's law, and in many cases they are about as high as predicted by Byerly's law, suggesting a kind of a strong crust. Now there's exceptions in the case of stress measurements made near major faults like the San Andreas, but this is going to turn out to be a problem for us later on when we toward the end of the talk. So there's a contrast between these very low frictions that we'll be looking at during the talk and what we tend to think of as static friction or relatively low slip velocity friction, even though there is some velocity dependence. And the dilemma we're going to come back to at the end of this a little bit, although it's not going to be the main focus of the talk, is that if the dynamic friction at meter per second rates, which is kind of a typical seismic slip rate, is low, then either the stress drops may be large because they may be dropping from 0.6 down to 0.1 or less times the normal stress gives you big stress drops, which would potentially create extreme ground motions. And this tends to be larger stress drops than one tends to mostly observe, although in some cases that's for small earthquakes. Sometimes it is observed. Or maybe the tectonic stress is actually lower so that the stress drops aren't that big, but then we have a problem with matching it with the stress measurement. So I'll come back to that, and that's not really the main focus of the talk, but it's kind of some of the implications of these results. Sure. Yep.
Which is, how is it that you go from a stress to a friction point? How is the friction pushing down on the stress?
Well, the stress, at least during slipping, is the shear stress on the fault during slipping is the normal stress times the coefficient of friction. And so if you're slipping slowly on the faults, or if static friction is high, so it takes a fairly high stress, namely 0.6 times whatever the normal stress is, to overcome slip, to get it started, and then it slips very slow, very much, much weaker at higher slip rates, a meter a second, then the stress changes are very large. And the seismologists feel that they can determine that they aren't typically that large, although in some cases they are. And there's questions about how they determine stress drops and so forth, which I'm not too qualified to address.
But the point that they are determining both normal and shear stresses.
Well, we guess what the normal stresses are from the depth, basically. And a typical effective normal stress, that is the normal stress due to the weight of the overlying rock minus the weight of the pore pressure, the effective normal stress, assuming that you have a connectivity between the, there's no high pressure fluid trapped at depth, is about 18 MPa per kilometer of depth. So you can multiply that for earthquakes typically nucleate the good sized ones typically nucleate at maybe 8 kilometers or so, 5 to 10 kilometers. So you multiply that times the normal stress and you get a pretty big stress, and if it drops to essentially zero, then that's a big stress drop. And as Tommy Heaton says, if they were all that big, the walls would knock us over by the fact that they're accelerating into us, and that's not what happens during earthquakes. So,
if you have two continents to smoke against each other, don't you get some additional stress coming from there?
Well, that's right. And so this is, one of the problems is, of course, you don't know what the normal stress on vertical planes is. You only know what the normal stress on horizontal planes is. And so in the case of a strike slip environment, we presume that the least principal stress is that the intermediate principal stress is the vertical one, and that may be, that's a kind of a roughly in the vicinity of what the normal stress on the fault might be if you do a Mohr circle construction or something. So, you know, we don't know precisely what they are, but these dilemmas we're going to see are so big that it's not obvious how you can overcome them in spite of those kinds of uncertainties. So,
one last question.
Yeah.
How do you measure shear stress?
You don't. You don't. You infer shear stress by multiplying the coefficient of friction that we're determining in the lab times normal stress. And of course, if it isn't frictional, then that's not the right thing to do. And that will come back to be an issue we'll discuss when we start talking about shear melting, which may produce viscous resistance instead of frictional resistance. So what I want to first do is go through a list of mechanisms for reduction in friction at high slip rates, just kind of, so you'll see that there's a lot of them, but I'm not going to discuss most of these in detail. I'll kind of go through them some. If we spend too much time discussing them, we won't get to the part that I really know about, so, you know, ask whatever you want, but be forewarned, we'll be here forever if we spend too much time on the first few. And then for the last several, there's at least some recent laboratory results on them, which is what I really want to show you, so you can, we can kind of think about that. And then at the end, as I say, a little bit about the implications. The problem that we as experimentalists have is that the conditions during earthquakes are pretty extreme, and it's hard to reproduce these in the lab. You need high slip rates, kind of in this vicinity probably, large displacements, at least on some faults, this big, in any case a meter or so for a reasonable size earthquake, fairly high effective normal stresses, and elevated pore fluid pressures, something on the vicinity of that times the vertical stress, depending on whether the vertical stresses, the pore fluid pressure is equal to the vertical stress, or whether it's 4/10 of it, which is what you expect for hydrostatic pore pressure, that is the weight of the overlying column of water compared to the weight of the overlying column of rocks. The water is about 4/10 the density of the rocks. So these, getting all of these simultaneously in a laboratory experiment is not an easy thing to do. And so experimental data presently compromise on one or more of these depending on the experiments we're addressing, and one of our hopes is that we can gradually do a better job of conducting experiments that are more realistic conditions, but it's a real problem. Okay, so here's a list of eight weakening mechanisms that should happen at co-seismic slip rates. I'll go through the first four pretty quickly and then spend more time on the last four, especially the last three. This may not be a totally exhaustive list, but it pretty much lists all the ones that, you know, I could think of that people have been discussing in the last few years. Okay, so let's stick at the first one, normal interface vibrations. We'll go through them one by one. Jim Bruhn and co-authors proposed this in the early 90s, and it's a somewhat poorly understood mechanism. The idea is that during sliding, there either is may actually be opening of the surfaces, or there may be at least reductions of normal stress. And if that's the case, then the shear resistance would be a lot lower. It could be zero if it actually opens during sliding. Now, it's not really, I may not be up to date on this, but last time I knew, it wasn't really theoretically predicted. If you're dealing with two elastic bodies sliding past each other that have the same elastic properties. If you have bimaterials that is different elastic properties, it's the kind of next mechanism which I will talk about, and that one is sort of more well understood and theoretically should happen. But Jim Bruhn has been, and his co-workers have been doing experiments on the foam rubber blocks. The reason they do this is because they do a better job of simulating dynamic properties because the density is low and the moduluses are low and so forth, so that they scale more appropriately in many ways. But of course, foam rubber isn't rock, and there are, along the foam rubber sliding interface, there are little kind of dangling kind of foam rubber hooks and things where you cut through the structure of the foam rubber. So there's questions about to what extent the experimental observations really match what you'd see in the real world, but nonetheless, it's kind of intriguing. One way Jim Bruhn often talks about this is that if you have fault with small-scale roughness and it's sliding along, you might expect that the bumps would kind of hit into each other and that there would be some transfer of momentum kind of in a normal direction from the horizontal sliding, and that this might cause some opening as well. So This idea, you know, I mean, this may or may not happen. It probably depends on the amplitude and wavelength and various things of these bumps, but at least that's a possibility. So I think, suffice to say, it's not a very well understood mechanism, but it could be important for earthquakes. I don't think we can dismiss it out of hand, but we don't know a lot about it. And unless you have questions, I'm going to go on, because I don't think we have too much more to say about it right now. Okay, this mechanism we know a lot better. Wirtman first proposed this. A lot of people have studied it more recently. And it basically involves dynamic reductions of normal stress during sliding at the rupture tip on a bimaterial interface. And one way to think about it, and you often get a wrinkle-like pulse. And one way to think about it is if you've got two materials sliding past each other, let's say this is the more compliant one, you can kind of get it's more compliant, so, and this area up here is under compression, so the part behind here is moving, and the part up front hasn't moved yet, so it kind of opens up like this. And at the rupture tip, on this side, there's a normal stress decrease. In the other direction, there's a normal stress increase, but at least in the... And so the rupture tends to propagate somewhat unilaterally, at least in depending on the parameters, part of parameter space you're in. So there's been a lot of studies, as you can see, and you do predict that it should occur, and there is at least some evidence that some ruptures on certain sections of faults may always rupture in the same direction, although there's not a lot of data on that, suggesting that perhaps this might happen. How big this effect is depends on the magnitude of the elastic mismatch and on the difference between the static and dynamic friction. Elastic mismatches that exist across the San Andreas Fault are from 5 to 30%, and those are sufficient to make a reasonable kind of asymmetry in the behavior of the problem. They don't really talk about this, of course, in terms of in any of the papers, in terms of kind of what you might think of as an effective reduction of the coefficient of friction. And of course, it isn't really that; it's a reduction in the normal stress. And usually, they just discuss the way the ruptures behave, rather than really, at least in my quick looking at it, kind of calculating how large reductions in the normal stress can you get. Nonetheless, it may be that I just haven't studied it enough, but. It seems pretty clear that this may well be important for earthquakes because we do have these elastic mismatches, and there's some data suggesting that there's unilateral rupture, and so I think it's a mechanism that may be important. How much difference it really makes, I don't think we know at this point. This is a mechanism we know even less about. Jay Malosh proposed this, first thinking about landslides. The idea is that if you have a granular aggregate that's shearing at high speed, there's maybe acoustic waves bouncing around inside it that they have the sort of basically air pressure is enough to kind of hold the particle partly apart, to fluidize the material to some extent, and so reduce the shear resistance. It's an interesting idea. I don't know whether it actually occurs. I once reviewed a proposal to do experiments trying to do this, but they either didn't get funded or they haven't published the results or didn't work. I don't know because I haven't seen any results. So it's not very well understood. I kind of question whether it's important for earthquakes, but in this business, you never quite know. And this last of these first four mechanisms that I'm going through quickly is elastohydrodynamic lubrication. Emily Brodsky and Hiro Kanemori proposed it in 2001. The idea is, and I'll show a diagram in the next slide, that if you've got a fluid between two irregular sliding surfaces, that during the sliding, if the fluid is viscous enough that's kind of being squeezed by the gaps that are closing, the fluid pressure may become increased there and would be decreased in the opening gaps. But to the extent that there's a net increase in pressure, then the effective normal stress will go down and there'll be somewhat reduced shear stress resistance. So that's kind of the idea. And in order to get the, I understand from reading their paper, you know, moderately carefully, but in order that the increase in pressure in the closing gaps kind of is a bigger effect than a decrease in pressure in the opening gap, so that on the average you have a reduction in the effective normal stress, the elastohydrodynamic part of this is that there's elastic deformation caused by this increase in fluid pressure that sort of makes the situation somewhat asymmetrical and makes the net increase in pressure a little bit larger than the decrease. I already said this. Hydrodynamic lubrication is well known in journal bearings, where you have a circular hole and a smaller size circular shaft rotating in it, and fluid kind of gets trapped in the leading edge of it, and it builds up high fluid pressures, and and can give pretty good lubrication, but the geometry there is more favorable than it, that I'll show in the next slide. There's really no relevant experiments on this. Water's not viscous enough. Maybe more viscous fluids like melt or silica gel that might be present on the fault might somehow cause weakening due to this effect, but they may just cause weakening because they're a weak fluid there anyway. So I think we don't, I'm a little bit dubious about this mechanism, but you never know. So here's a diagram sort of showing the idea. If this is shearing along, or this is shown as though you've got a flat surface, but the composite topography looked like this, then the fluid pressure is going to build up in this area and decrease over here because the viscous fluid's kind of trying to flow back into here, and it doesn't make it if you're sliding fast enough. So the pressure buildup is related to the viscosity and the velocity and the length scale of the asperities and the change in height, proportional to the change in height and inversely proportional to the cube of the actual height. So if you put in the numbers here, as I say, it doesn't work for water. Whether it works for other things, you know, is not clear. Okay, so I talked about these first four, and now I'm going to talk more about these other ones. And we'll start with thermal pressurization of pore fluids. I'll say less about this because there's less experimental evidence for it at the moment, but hopefully that will change. Rick Simpson initially proposed this. A lot of other people have studied it in numerical studies and analytical studies. The idea is that thermal expansion of a pore fluid in the fault, if the rocks are relatively impermeable, and if you have rapid enough and localized enough slip, then you can get elevated temperatures. And these elevated temperatures will, by the thermal expansion of the pore fluid, cause the fluid pressure to increase, which reduces the effective normal stress, and as a consequence, you'll get some weakening. Now, if there's delay latency in the fault zone, that is, if the fault zone, due to slip, either at the beginning of slip and if it persists with continued slip, then it doesn't take too much opening, that is, increase of volume of the fault zone in which this expanding fluid resides, to overcome the volume expansion of the fluid. So whether or not dilatancy will kill it off is not really clear, but it certainly could if the latency is enough. Jim Wright, who's studied this a lot recently, believes that at the beginning there may be some dilatancy, but it won't persist with slip. I'm not completely convinced that that's true, and we need to think more about it. Right now, we don't really have any experimental evidence for it. I'll show you some abortive attempts that David Goldsmith and I did a few years ago to do it, and we're going to turn back to this because we now know how to do it, we think. So it's pretty well understood theoretically. It's still not clear what's applicable to faults, but it could be quite important, and it's one of the two mechanisms that Jim Rice uses in a lot of his calculations about how weak faults may be during high-speed slip. So here's a diagram I stole from Jim Rice. The idea is you've got this shearing zone. In this zone, you've got heat per unit volume being built up. The heat flows out at some rate. If there's fluid in here, the fluid flows out at some rate, so you've got fluxes of heat and fluid. And so by just saying that the increase in heat, the energy put in, either goes into increasing the temperature, both goes into increasing the temperature of the region, and heat that's flowing out to the sides. And if you assume that the heat doesn't flow out, and some of these papers kind of show that if the fault zone is the appropriate thickness and so forth, that's not too bad an assumption, then all you really have to worry about is the fluid flowing out. And you have to worry about the increase in fluid pressure due to the temperature increase in the time dependent increase in pressure is, and the sort of a volume coefficient for the increase of temperature with time, and a coefficient that relates the increase in temperature to the increase in pressure. This has to do with the dilatancy, and this is Kempton's coefficient. And that's balanced by the kind of heat that's flowing out, basically, which is in the heat that's flowing out is given by this, where we've got the rate of heat generation and the viscosity of it and so forth. So you can run all this either through analytical models or through numerical models, and you find that you should get some weakening. Now, David Goldsmith and I tried to do some experiments in the late 90s to look into this, and this is experiments done in the rotary shear machine that I've been working on for years at Brown. Here's the overall design of the machine. There's a motor down here that rotates a piston around and round and round, as well as having axial stress. and a blow up of the inside. You can see the scale here. The sample is sitting in here. It's sealed from the surrounding confining pressure, which is gas, by O-rings and Teflon jackets. And not shown here, we have the capability, we have a port on both the top and the bottom so that we have a hole that comes out through here connected to a pipe that goes up so we can have pore fluid pressure coming one side, another one coming in the other side that then kind of goes up the top and wraps around on the bottom if you want to rotate some. So in this particular experiment I'm going to describe, what we did was we took a rock of very low permeability because we, during the high speed part of the experiment, we don't want the water to leak out. So we saturated the water, the sample for about a week by looking to see whether water was coming out the top port and pumping it in the bottom. And after we finally saw water coming out of the top port and knew we had it saturated with water, we then took the thing out of the machine, sealed off the top bottom port because we can't rotate very far, and then put it back in, pressurized the top, and then after spending a week kind of getting it all set up, the experiment was over in just a few minutes. And so then we started rotating this fast, and the results you'll see in the next slide. Yeah. Yes, these are rings. So I don't have a kind of a perspective view of them, but so their axis is the axis of rotation of this, and so they are sliding on their common interface. And the value of this, of course, is that you can slide very long displacements, so it allows us to do a lot of things that it's hard to do in other kind of geometries. The disadvantage, of course, is that there's a slightly higher velocity on the outside diameter than the inside diameter of the ring, but that's only a fairly, it's like a 10% difference or so. And the since a lot of the frictional behavior depends on the log of the velocity instead of the velocity itself, it's not a big effect. Also, when you do velocity steps, you have the same ratio of change of velocity in the outside to the inside, and most everything depends on the log of velocity. So it's not, there's nothing perfect except real earthquakes, but it's not too bad. Okay, so this is the data, plotted as a function of displacement, and here we've got the actual shear stress divided by the shear stress at the beginning of the experiment. And this is done because this plot here comes out of a paper in Mason Smith in which we've adjusted their displacement scale to go with the fact that in their paper they have slip rates of a meter a second and we have 2.5 orders of magnitude slower than that in this experiment. So it turns out that you can, if this is different, you can just shift the displacement scale by 2.5 orders of magnitude and the results look fine, look the same way. So this is how they predicted what the fall off should be depending on the permeability. So for infinite permeability, a permeability of zero, there's no leakage of fluid off and the stress falls off faster. For permeability of 10 to the minus 16 meters squared, it drops off like this. For infinite permeability, it doesn't drop off at all, of course. The pressure just can never build up. And the data tends to kind of fall down more or less along the 10 to the minus 19, 10 to the minus 18 square meter lines. We don't really understand this jump here, but it's a lot more things we don't understand. So, but the rock actually had this permeability of 10 to the minus 19. So this looked pretty good. We thought, we wrote an AG abstract and said, this shows that we've got this mechanism of increase of pore pressure, masses of theory and all that. But we made perhaps the mistake of doing a control experiment without any water in there. And here's the result. The dry samples, the green and the red lines, decayed just as much as the wet sample did. So this is not the right explanation for this mechanism. The explanation turns out to be the silica gel one I'll talk about near the end of this talk. And so what we need is to do these experiments on some kind of rock that doesn't show gel weakening. And we've discovered that gabbro is in that category, as you'll see later on. And so David's got an experiment all kind of geared up to do on gabbro when maybe he's doing it back at Brown that he's back there. So the status of this is that experimental evidence on it is still needed. And one of the things we're going to find out, because we can measure at least the normal separation between the surfaces during sliding, we'll find out to what extent dilatancy kills this off or doesn't, whether we see this mechanism or not. There's other things to do to think about dilatancy. But so we don't have a lot of information except theoretically on this one, and we obviously need more. Now I want to talk about another mechanism, which, again, Jim Rice and Nadia Lapusta have been doing using a lot in their modeling of dynamic ruptures, namely flash melding at asperity contacts. And this is a mechanism that's been known for quite a long time. Bowden-Tabor discovered it. Various other folks have studied it more recently. The idea is, and I'll show a diagram in the next picture and show some equations from Jim Rice's theory of this, it involves local transient heating of short-lived contacts. And they don't last very long, but the stresses are very high at these asperity contacts, as far as we know. And so the shear stresses are quite high as well, and consequently the heat input rate is pretty high. And it's possible to get pretty local heating, even though the overall fault surface is not heating up very much. And so the reduction in shear resistance from this either comes from thermal softening, just higher temperature plastic deformation of the material, or perhaps melting and viscous shearing of the melt. As we'll see, it's only effective above a velocity that depends on the local strength, namely what the contact stress is, and the dimensions of the asperities. So we'll find out that the theory and the observations seem to match each other pretty well on this. It's observed originally by Bowden and Tabor in transparent materials where they actually saw flashes of light, which is why it's called flash heating. We've observed, and also Vikas Prakash has observed in experiments I'll show you the results of soon here, weakening that at least fits the predictions of this mechanism. Whether it's actually this mechanism, we still need to sort of determine. And so this mechanism could be important for earthquakes, and as I say, Jim Rice and Nadia Lapusta are using it a lot in their modeling. So I've already said this. Here's a surface sliding along, and these little red spots are where it's getting hot, and if it's transparent, you can actually look through and see these kind of flashing on and off as the asperity population keeps changing during high-speed slip. So Jim Rice, it's only published in an AGU abstract, but he has this elegant, simple model for the strength as a function of velocity, which we'll look at in the next couple of slides. Nick Beeler and I have kind of, but Nick did most of the work, have extended this for a distribution of asperity sizes, and assuming that the contacts, when they melt, don't become zero strength, is what Jim Rice assumed, but have some finite strength. And those two modifications seem to make it fit the data somewhat better. So here's the beginning of a couple of slides showing Jim Rice's analysis. Here's a cross-section of a surface. Here's these surfaces that are kind of short-lived. Here's a planar view of just a distribution of sizes of asperities for kind of to fill up the slide, I guess. So the contact size or the distance across here is d, which obviously varies, but in Rice's analysis, it's just one number. Velocity is the slip rate. The contact lifetime is therefore the diameter divided by the velocity. And we're going to use Tw for the weakening temperature and Tf for fault as the average fault temperature. So this is kind of the average ambient temperature of, say, the experiment or the fault in nature. As time passes, this may gradually climb up because you are putting heat into these asperities. And for the lifetime of the asperity, it doesn't heat up the whole rock very much. But over time, you keep dumping enough heat in, and the average background heat temperature finally becomes high enough that it could start melting the whole region in a layer, which we'll kind of see as one of the later weakening mechanisms. Now, what Jim Rice assumes is that, the idea would be that if you plot shear stress at the asperity contact versus temperature, that it would actually probably weaken something other like this. It would gradually soften, and eventually you'd get the melting point, and it might be zero strength or almost zero strength. He makes the simple assumption that it's an on-off kind of deal, so that there's a weakening temperature. At less than a weakening temperature, it has the same strength it would kind of a normal shear stress from coefficient of friction times normal stress. And above the weakening temperature, it's essentially zero strength. So Nick Beeler's assumed that it's not zero and that there's a variety of different contact spot sizes. And it makes some difference, but not a huge amount. So the way the theory works is this, that we're going to have, not only do we have the lifetime of the asperities, theta itself, but we've got theta w, the time to weaken. So it takes a certain amount of time for the weakening to occur, and this shows how you get this. The way you do it is that the heat input, which is the time that it, over which the heat is being input times the velocity and the shear stress, this input goes into storing energy over some distance. So if we go back for a minute here, this is a one-dimensional calculation, so it's assumed that at each spot on the contact, the heat is being generated here, and it only flows perpendicular to the surface because you don't have very long for this all to be happening, and the so it flows some effective distance in and heats up some kind of effective width or you know thickness of the material on both sides of the sliding surface, and so this is the effective distance here. So you create this to that times that and rearrange, and you get the time to weaken is this, inversely proportional to the square of the velocity, and it will weaken if the time to weakening is less than the lifetime of the asperity. So if the asperity lasts long enough that it can weaken, then it'll weak. Otherwise, it won't weaken. So in this case, the weakening time is less than the lifetime of the contact asperity if the velocity is greater than this weakening velocity, which is given by this expression. And representative values for the this is the thermal diffusivity here are these. So quite high contact stresses here. We used in this calculation 7 GPa. This gives a weakening temperature of about a tenth of a meter per second for the onset of severe thermal weakening. I'll show a plot of this versus log velocity in a minute. In addition, and the arguments for this aren't presented here, we could go through them at least kind of schematically if you wanted, but the friction below this weakening velocity, the friction is basically its normal value of about 0.6, let's say, mu naught. Above the weakening velocity, the friction is 0.6 times, and it's inversely proportional to the velocity. So it's times the weakening temperature, weakening velocity over the normal velocity, over the actual velocity, and we'll see that what that looks like in a plot. So the experiments that David David in this case, have done to test this are in this Instron testing machine that he may have discussed, that some of you may have heard about last week. It's a simple unconfined experiment. Geometrically, it's fairly similar to our confined ones, but it's just done kind of out on the benchtop. So there's just a plate of rock here, and the top piece of rock is a ring, the same diameter as the ones that we do in our high-pressure experiments. And we use this apparatus for a couple different tests. In this particular, and we'll come back to that later, but in this particular one, we use it in its highest speed mode possible. This is the rotation is driven by a rotary actuator that only has 90 degrees of rotation. And so if you kind of suddenly pump as much oil as you can into the vanes of the actuator, the highest speed you can get it to go resolved on the lever arm of the size of our sample is about 4/10 of a meter a second. So it's 40% of a kind of a typical co-seismic slip rate. The displacements are only 40 millimeters. And you can only, since this is unconfined, you can't do it at too high normal stress, only 5 MPa, or the rock starts falling apart. This is a result from one kind of typical experiment. This is on quartz, 190 degree rotation. In the red, we're plotting the velocity. So initially, we're sliding very, very slowly, a millimeter a second, or a few microns a second. And then suddenly we speed it up, and it takes a little while to ramp up the speed, and then it slides along kind of more or less constant rate, and then finally drops down at the end as it comes to the end of its travel. The friction drops down and then gradually comes back up again. And there's some oscillations in this which we don't totally understand, but we think it's kind of a dynamic interaction between the constitutive properties of the rock and the mechanical properties of the machine. It is not stick slip. That is, you can resolve these, they don't load up and then drop right down. Whereas at slower rates, sometimes we do get stick slip in this machine. So if we cross-plot friction versus velocity, or log velocity, what we see is this. You start at low speed, friction is high. As it starts speeding up, the friction goes down. Here's these oscillations. As it slows down at the end of the experiment, it comes back up again. And so at lower speeds, you know, we don't see this weakening until we get to about a tenth of a meter a second. And it's reversible with no time delay. That is, this experiment is over in a tenth of a second. Okay? And in contrast to what we'll see with the gel weakening mechanism, which I'm going to talk about later, which has a time constant of 300 seconds or so to recover its strength, this one essentially instantaneously is virtually as strong as it was before. I'm not sure this difference between this and this is significant. Now, shown on here are the predictions of Rice's theory and the modification that Nick Beeler and I have made. And you can see that with this modification, it goes to the data somewhat better, but basically they both kind of show that at above some temperature, it seems to weaken quite abruptly, and the amount of weakening is pretty much matched by the theory. That doesn't mean it's the right explanation, but at least it's consistent with it, and we're going to try to think about what else we might be able to do to figure out if it's really this mechanism. I'll come back to that in a moment. We find this for quartz. We find this for granite. We find this for gabbro. And note that in gabbro, we do not see the next mechanism I'm going to talk about, the gel weakening mechanism. So this is clearly a different mechanism, even though they're not quite in the same velocity range and so forth. So it seems to occur for, you know, a variety of rocks that we've looked at so far. I think David looked at calcite and didn't see it, but you don't expect calcite to melt in the same kind of way. It may decrease.
You have the same 0.1 meter per second.
Yeah, that's true. On the other hand, the various parameters that go into this may not be too different. I mean, the surface roughnesses were similar, so D is about the same. Doubt if the thermal properties are all that different. Heat capacity and so forth is, and the density aren't all that different. Theoretical strength, they both consist of, or all three of them consist of pretty strong minerals. I mean, these all have kind of similar kind of indentation hardnesses and so forth. So, you know, a thing to try to investigate would be to try to do it with materials with somewhat different strengths here. Then that might make some difference, and I'm going to discuss the possibility of using different temperatures and different Ds in order to evaluate this. But yeah, so whether it's a coincidence or not, it's.
So you've not done different surface roughnesses to vary.
Not yet, but that's, as you'll see, that's in one of my subsequent slides here. I haven't really thought about it a lot. We do modeling of some kind of oscillations like this in other cases. We just haven't gotten to this one yet. But if this is a tenth of a second, you know, it's there's, what, 20 of these or something like that in a tenth of a second, so you get some idea.
And it's not due to the compliance or anything?
Well, it is in some sense. I mean, it is some kind of a machine-rock interaction. I think that's pretty clear. We haven't tried... Well, we did try. I can't remember. We have a torque sensor in there, which is what's measuring ultimately the friction coefficient.
And that has a resonance frequency.
Well, that's right. And the whole machine has some kind of resonant frequency to it. One of the things we've talked about doing, but I don't know that we've actually done it. Was to change the moment of inertia of some of the rotating or non-rotating parts to see whether or not that would affect this, but we haven't really done that. We probably can't change the torsional stiffness too much. We could change it some, but so that would be another thing to try to investigate. So we haven't really tried to analyze these. I mean, it's one of the things we have worried about is whether this might actually involve some kind of sort of bouncing in normal separation, some of these other mechanisms, instead of it staying in contact the whole time. So we've got some thoughts about how we might sort of look at that, about putting some acoustic transducers in there and maybe doing some experiments with some electrical contacts across there to see whether or not the electrical continuity is affected at all as we slide. So we have worried to some extent about whether the whole weakening might be something other than this gel weakening, I mean this flash weakening, and might just kind of coincidentally seem to more or less match its predictions. And so I would say that at this point the jury is still out on what this is. I mean, you know, we are saying that we think it's due to flash heating. Jim Rice is using this as support of his theory and his modeling, but I still think we have to be cautious about whether or not it's what we think it is. And trying to understand the role the machine has on it is certainly part of that.
There are data on vibrationally induced reduction of friction coefficients. Now, whether this is relevant or not...
Right, that's right. Well, that's it. It could be. We don't have... I mean, the macroscopic normal displacement is not changing, but that's measured by an LVDT that's somewhere not right on the sample, and so it might not see this, and so we need to kind of think about various ways of trying to instrument this, which is we've been thinking about putting some accelerometers on the surface for both tangential and normal displacements, and also just kind of to see what we can see about acoustic emissions coming out of it and so forth. So there's a bunch more things we need to do to try to nail this down.
In the question you showed, was the diameter of the contact diode?
The diameter of the contact...
D.
That's D, yeah.
The distribution of such values.
There's a distribution of such values. Well, that's what... Whoops, where am I going? I'm going the wrong direction, sorry. That's what this theory here sort of takes into account. It takes into account some kind of distribution of contact diameters.
And how do you know that?
Well, we have some idea from it from porphyrometry that's been done on surfaces with this kind of roughness that have been treated in the same way, but we haven't done those measurements on these particular samples. So we have some idea about what that is, but we don't know it too well. And I forget actually how much of the difference between this prediction and that prediction. Part of it clearly has to do with the level at which they're eventually going. This is heading towards zero, and this is heading towards some higher value, which is part of the difference between these. The weakening friction, the value of the friction when it's weakened, in Rice's case, is zero, and in our case is above zero. So that has something to do with this. In this prediction, I actually can't remember right now whether the one I'm showing on here includes this distribution of sizes. So it does make some difference to the predictions, but it doesn't seem to make a big difference to the predictions based on what we think we know about the distribution of sizes.
So, this question about the 10 to minus 1 commonality here.
Right.
The fits that you're showing, I'm wondering what are the three parameters in those fits?
Well,
put in all of those thermal properties and thermal diffusivity.
I confess, David has done this, so I don't know. These are the values that these are the values that he used for all of them. But whether or not, so these are the free parameters. And these were ones that, I mean, these are not fits. These were our guesses as to the best values for these parameters. And they predict this 0.1 meter a second sort of weakening velocity. Now, Rice, in one of his papers, and we use 1,000 degrees K here, Rice was, in one of his papers, or at least one of his talks that I've got data from him on, was using 700 degrees here instead because he was assuming that it was granite that was going to melt at about 600, and then it started with an ambient temperature of a couple hundred, I forget, so maybe it was even lower than that, he assumed. And he assumed, I think, a lower value for this and twice as large for this. So there's a certain amount of uncertainty in some of these. He ended up with a prediction of 0.3 meters a second. Well, to the resolution of the log plot, they look about the same. But so it's not fit to that. But what I don't remember is whether these plots that I show... It's not that I don't remember, I don't actually know. I think these are all the same curves without having to tailor them to the different materials. So it's kind of a how much they'd change if you tried to get a better idea for the values for the rocks, I'm not sure. Yeah?
If you change the total sliding distance and the peak velocity, you can't make it higher, I understand, you make them both smaller.
Right.
Do you see the same crossover point?
If we only go to a meter a second, we don't see anything.
If you go to 0.2 meters a second instead of 0.4, do you see
I don't know that we've tried that. I think we were pushing it for all we could get, so it's a good question.
And if you look at the one at 0.1 where you don't see the softening,
right.
You look at the surfaces for any evidence existence of
We don't see any evidence like that in this case either. I mean, that's another thing that we need to do, which is probably what one of my other slides is going to address. But it's very hard. It's not clear whether you'd actually be able to see anything or not. You might, and I'll show some atomic force microscope measurements of surface topography that suggest for some of Vikas Prakash's experiments that we interpret as having the same explanation for the weakening. He sees some flattened off tops of things and attributes it to sort of melting of them, but you know, it could be something else, you don't know. It's very hard to find the asperities and then to kind of go down and actually look at them in any particular way and figure out, you know, is there a thin layer of amorphous stuff on them. It's very, you know, the analytical challenges of doing that are pretty tough. And so we've tried looking at SEM images, and you know, sometimes we think, well, maybe there's something there, but, and you know, it's very hard to do. We've not been able to do TEM to actually look at the, you know, near the tip of an asperity, because they're just tiny little things. They kind of get destroyed, you know, the contacts get destroyed when you take the thing apart. There may be something left over you could find, but it's really very hard to see much. So
Leon Kieran Jane Wang have looked at that a little bit. Yeah. They have this model where they actually, with a roughness model, to simulate that phenomenon. I know there are some experiments they compare with, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd be interested to find out more about that, because if they've got some, you know, if there's a similar enough situation, if they've got some ways of trying to kind of zero in and look at things that they think they've got local flash melding from, I'd love to find out about that, because as you'll see in a subsequent slide, we feel we really need to try to do a better job of that. We've made some kind of half-hearted attempts and haven't seen anything.
But I'm remembering that the thing they concentrated more on was not going up to the temperature where there was melting, but simply the fact that there's a temperature rise causes sufficient thermal expansion that changes the contact mechanics and can cause, you know, separation changes in pressure.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually what they focus more on.
I see. Okay.
There are experiments,
yeah,
that people have done
always
in local
melting. That they attribute to be due to local melding. Huh? Yeah, okay. Well, that's well, whatever. I mean, if they can see something, then maybe we can too if it's the right explanation. So I'm intrigued by that. Thank you.
Do you see any gouge in these experiments?
In these ones, and the other ones I'm going to talk about, where we slide a lot farther and do the looking at the gel development, there's quite a bit of gouge. It doesn't stay in because it's unconfined, so it kind of squirts out to the inside and the outside diameter of the ring. And I'm sure there's some, but I don't know that that we slide far enough. I mean, just 40 millimeters that we get very much. But, you know, I'm sure, and the normal stresses aren't super high, but I mean, based on Jim's experiments at those kinds of normal stresses and displacements, I'm sure there's some. I just don't know how much there is. And, you know, that's one of the things that complicates your thinking about flash melding, is that if you've actually got a layer of gouge in there that is in any way kind of isolating the two surfaces from each other, then, you know, well, maybe you have flash melding at asperity contacts in the gouge, or maybe it's undergoing uniform shearing over a very thin layer. I mean, most of the evidence that we've got at somewhat larger scales than here is that you get extreme localization and the gouge doesn't really participate very much in most of the deformation. But at this scale, I can't say we've been able to say that or not. And we haven't done all we've mostly done is taken these things apart, and you know, there's a little bit of, I think there's probably a little dusting of powder on there, but
you have a high enough roughness, and conceivably the gouge falls into the gaps, and it's not a problem.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah. Okay, other questions? Okay, I'm now going to talk about some experiments that Vikas Prakash has done at Case Western. He was a PhD at Brown with Rod Clifton, and this particular technique is one that he used in his PhD thesis. So it's a gas gun, but instead of normal incidence, which is what I normally think of for people doing high pressure kind of transient impact experiments, it's inclined, and they spend a lot of time getting the fire plate and the target plate exactly in the right orientation. They've got a holographic diffraction grating on the back, and knowing sort of how the waves travel back and forth inside this thing, they can, by observing the back of the thing, they can figure out both the normal and the transverse displacement, the direction using interferometry. So they can pretty well understand what's going on the sliding surface, assuming that the target plate is actually behaving elastically. And so they've done this on various materials where it is elastic, and they, you know, when he first started doing this, we were working together on this project to some extent, and we've sent him a variety of rocks, and he finally found one of the navaculites that we used was good enough that it didn't break up, and it really was elastic. It was pretty good. Westerly granite was, you know, that we all love for doing experiments on, was terrible. The other technique that he's used so far, and there's a third one that I'll describe briefly that he hasn't used, is using the torsional Kolsky bar apparatus, which is a pretty well-established kind of technique. So here he's got the target and, again, a ring, a tube-shaped rock sitting on the end of this input bar. And so this is clamped here, and you apply some normal stress at the end. You first torque up this hydraulic pulley system, you apply some normal stress, and then when you release this clamp, you send a torsional stress wave down here, and you get rapid slip. The other method I don't actually have that he's just starting to work on now is he has a rotating plate over here, which is very close, which is rotating at some known speed, and then this would be sitting very near it, stationary, and then it's driven again rapidly against the surface, but now the rotation is coming from the rotating plate. So I haven't seen any results from that other method yet, but this is a kind of a pilot project through the Southern California Earthquake Center to explore the possibilities of using some of these new techniques for studying high-speed friction. And they've seemed to pan out pretty well. So all the results we've got are just kind of tantalizing, but I think the hope is that Vikas may send in, with me or not on it, depending, a proposal to NSF to try to investigate this more thoroughly. So the range of conditions that are accessible in the pressure shear friction experiment and the Kolsky bar are here. The rotating disc has similar capabilities, but there's somewhat more control over what goes on. So normal stresses can be quite high in this one, not nearly so high here. Slip speeds can be quite high, not quite as high here, but plenty high enough for our purposes. The slip distances here are quite small in this impact experiment. Whereas here they are not huge, but at least they're large enough that there may be something useful from it. Results from the impact pressure shear pilot experiments. Here we're plotting slip velocity, which is this. So it starts out already on this plot. We're already at 5 meters a second. It goes up to about 20 and comes down again. The stress is starting at 0.4 and comes down to about, the coefficient of friction, 0.4, and coming down to about 0.25 and going back up again. I don't completely understand why it is, but apparently there's always this kind of mirror image character between these things and this sort of machine, and so it makes me wonder a little bit to what extent, you know, to what extent it's somewhat controlled by the way the rock behaves. But nonetheless, the weakening that you get on the order of 0.2 or so, although, you know, it's not at all clear that these are steady state values or anything. Clearly, even at high slip speeds, this whole thing is at high slip speeds, the coefficient of friction is not as low as 0.2, but on the other hand, it's not 0.6 either. So, in general, our feeling is that this is probably compatible with flash melding, and maybe that this re-strengthening involves enlargement of a viscous melt layer, which I'll talk about in a minute for another mechanism, but that may or may not be the...
Extremely short.
Extremely short, that's right.
Is there significant decline of reasonable volume?
I don't know. I mean, you don't need much volume according to this flash melding mechanism, I think, because it's just a very thin layer right at the contact, so presumably it's possible. But
if you just ask, what is the, if you're going at 5 meters per second, and you only have 1 microsecond, and you've only gone 5 micrometers, which was the size of your contact. So if you look back at the analysis,
right,
the melting, it's
Yeah.
Just barely, so the first 1 microsecond, you can't.
That's a good point, right? Yeah, that's right. You haven't even slid the diameter of the contact spots yet, basically. Yeah. So conceivably, that's what this is. I mean, I don't know. The analysis that Nick and I did in this other paper was kind of trying to look in, sort of revising Rice's way of looking at it, but thinking about it from a different perspective, is sort of tries to address the evolution as a function of slip, but basically, as you're saying, it's got a characteristic decay distance on the order of the contact spot sizes, just like rate and state friction does. And so, you know, maybe we're seeing that, maybe we're not. I don't know. These are the topography of the surface before and afterwards from atomic force microscope. And the thought is that these kind of planed off tops, these images aren't too great, especially, it seemed like they look better in my computer, but that these planed off tops may be the kind of melted tips of these asperities. But, I mean, the dimensions here, you know, this is 10 microns, and these are kind of on the order of 5 to 10 microns in size, it seems, and that, you know, that kind of gets a little bit at your comment. So I don't know. I mean, even if there weren't melting, I would have expected that a lot of this topography would have been smoothed off. So it's not clear to me how you can say that when you see topography like this, that it's due to anything except rubbing between two surfaces. I mean, you know, maybe it's due to melding, maybe it isn't, but I don't know how you know. Yeah, it's, I mean, if you could, you know, if you could make a thin section across through here and see whether there's a thin layer, of a thin recrystallized layer that's frozen out of the melt or something, you might expect to see something different. That's not been done. As I say, these are just kind of very, I mean, I should back up and say that in a lot of ways, a lot of what I'm presenting here is really preliminary results, but particularly these ones with these mechanisms of vicuses are because they were just kind of intended to explore proof of concept for these techniques. So a lot more could be done. And we haven't tried AFM on our surfaces. We've now got some pretty good AFMs at Brown that we could try doing that on. But as far as looking through these, it's tricky to do, but conceivably you could observe the microstructure at those spots. That is, you're saying plastic deformation should do this too. Well, I think the peak normal stress is the yield stress. I mean, locally. I mean,
the peak in the experiment.
Oh.
What the peak normal stress?
I don't. That's something I probably can't tell you. Let's see.
Look at the range of the previous one. It went quite high, like 20 gigapascals.
Right.
2 gigapascals.
Yeah.
So if you're up around 2 gigapascals, you'd expect most of the surface to be flat.
Right.
It looks more or less like that.
Right. Well, that's kind of my feeling. I don't know what it is in these. It may be that somewhere else in my computer, I've got some more slides from that particular thing where you might have actually shown what it is. I can look that up. I won't do it right now, but afterwards I can look. But I suspect that it's closer to 2 gigapascals into 100 MPa in this experiment. So. Specimen was this an evacuolite, yeah.
And the hardness or something like that?
Well, about 10 GPa or so, roughly, right?
Like 20% of the contact would be flat.
I don't know if you said it, but an evacuolite is a coarse rock.
Yeah.
Can you tell from the AFM what the distribution of asperity sizes is? Is there a wide? I presume there's a wide range.
I mean, it looks like there is. Just kind of looking at. I mean, the only place you can really see much in this image is kind of looking along the profile on this edge and this edge, and it looks like there's, you know, some kind of larger ones and some kind of small radius of curvature ones here and so forth. So it looked like there's a pretty good variety to begin with. And I don't know exactly how this surface was prepared. I mean, I know what we do in our experiments, but I don't know how. You know, typically we grind these things flat with a surface grinder, and then in our experiments, at least. Probably he didn't do this, but I'm not sure. We roughen them up a little bit with some kind of abrasive powder grit on the surface to give us some kind of topography, which, anyway. But he may not have done that because he's interested in things being as kind of nice and perfect as he can. So I don't know. There is some porosity in the navaculites. I mean, navaculite is for those of you who don't know, is the kind of rock you often buy as a really good whetstone for sharpening your knives with. And the reason it's a good whetstone is that at least many of them have some porosity in them, not super well connected, but adequately connected. And so it's the sharp edges of these pore spaces that kind of do the cutting when you're kind of honing your knife on it. Now, this one is not nearly as porous as the other navaculites. We hunted for a bunch of them. He tried several, and he finally found one that was pretty tight. So I suspect this has not got as nearly as much porosity. But you know, some of these pits may be an initial porosity somehow.
Looking at the edge on the left and the edge on the right.
Yeah.
It seems like it's more than just the peaks that are getting sheared off. Like the small scale roughness looks a lot smoother on the right as well.
Yeah. I mean, this, yeah, and it's odd because this stuff down in here, I mean, it doesn't look like, at least it doesn't connect.
I'm not sure if the Z-range is the same.
Pardon?
I'm not sure if the Z-range.
Well, I think it is. I think this is a micron. There's a little micron down here that's kind of, I just got this slide from Vika, so I think this is a micron here, so it's not quite the same. This is a little bit, this has got more vertical exaggeration than this one does. It looks like I tried to blow them up so these scales were about the same. So, you know, maybe this is a little rougher than it looks compared to how this one is actually a little rougher than it looks compared to how this one looks. But it's interesting that what you were saying, Bruce, about, you know, these look pretty flat as the tops of these plateaus, presumably. But this plateau does not continue all the way to the back here, and yet this back, which presumably is below the part which was contacted by the other one because it's not part of the flat, it also seems a lot smoother than this. So, you know, I don't completely understand these images and what to make of them, but they were presented by Vikas as possible data suggesting there might be local flash melting, but it doesn't seem to me that it, you know, that it demonstrates anything except that the surfaces have kind of gotten the tops flattened off. And by what process, I don't know. So it's not incompatible with flash melting, I suppose, but I don't know that it really argues for it particularly. Okay, results from the Torshnikovsky bar. Here we're plotting velocity again in this line you can't see very well. So here the velocities start down here around a meter a second, go up to about 3 or 4 meters a second. The coefficient of friction bounces around a lot in here. I think this is his very first experiment, and I have a feeling that somewhere I could have found, but I couldn't seem to find it, one that was a little bit better. But anyway, the coefficient of friction is kind of bouncing around about 0.2 or so. So it's similar, crudely speaking, to what we found in our kind of single-shot, lower normal, longer displacement experiments. And so all of this kind of 0.2 type coefficient of friction we're tentatively suggesting maybe due to flash melting or flash weakening. So what can we do? This gets to some of the discussion we had earlier to try to verify whether it's due to flash weakening or melting or not. Well, I alluded already to this. If we just change the ambient temperature, then we can, you know, the square of the temperature difference here, the weakening temperature is presumably a constant temperature, some number of degrees Kelvin. And so if we are closer to or farther from that, it ought to predictably shift the weakening velocity. So by doing things at either cryogenic temperatures or elevated temperatures, we ought to be able to see whether or not the predictions is melt. And the other one is the one that Jim was suggesting, that if we change D, which we can do by changing the surface roughness, we also ought to change this. So clearly we need to do that, you know, if the predictions match the theory, that's fine. If it stays at 0.1 meter a second weakening, no matter what we do, then something else is going on. So we haven't done that yet. And also, as we discussed, it'd be nice to observe small amounts of melt, but the asperities, it's not that easy to sort of look right at the asperities. But I think we need to make more effort, and if some people have done some of these kinds of things in metallurgy, then I'd like to find out some references to that. Okay, now I want to talk about this next to the last mechanism, interfacial lubrication by frictional melt. I put this in this order because here we've got a little bit of weld melding. Now we've got a lot more melding. This was first proposed, I think, by Jeffries. McKenzie and Bruin have discussed it, and a lot of people have talked about it since. So there's enough frictional heating to create an actual layer of melt separating the blocks, and the shear resistance, you'd think it would be reduced, but of course you've got viscous coupling between them, and these melts can be, you know, moderately high viscosity, so it's not totally zero strength, probably. There's also kind of complicated theory on this, because as it gets weak, you no longer are dissipating so much heat into the layer, and so melting, you know, the tendency for it to melt sort of goes away, and at least John Spray claims in some of his experiments, who was one of the initial guys who did some of these things in a friction welding apparatus, that he had periodic freezing and thawing and freezing and thawing, that during one experiment it would kind of seize up, it would melt for a while, and then it would get cool enough that it would freeze up, and then it would break loose again, and I don't know whether that's plausible or not, but that's what he says. Yuri Ferralko tells me that he thinks that's not possible, but if you see it, it's possible. So most of the experiments on this have been done by Toshi Shimamoto and his colleagues in Japan, and they're done at low normal stresses, unconfined, and as we'll see, the strength is a complex function of slip. So it clearly occurs during some earthquakes because pseudotachylites are generated during some earthquakes. It's not clear how frequently. A lot of people think that there ought to be so much heat dissipated during earthquakes that almost all earthquakes should produce some pseudotachylites, and we don't see very many pseudotachylites. Pseudotachylite is a tachylite is a basalt glass, and a pseudotachylite is a melted rock by frictional heating on faults that sort of looks like a basalt glass but isn't. And there's also been some controversy about the origin of pseudotachylites. Most pseudotachylites are very dark, fine-grained looking rocks in a hand specimen or even in microscope, in a petrographic microscope, with little fragments of clastic particles kind of floating around in them. Most of them do not have devitrification textures and crystallites and things kind of that look like they grew out of melt, so you can't necessarily demonstrate that they were truly melted. Rudy Venk at Berkeley thinks that at least some pseudotachylites may actually be just the result of very fine sort of pulverization of the rock somehow, kind of a very fine-grained gouge material that somehow become fluidized and can flow and so forth. And so that takes me back to thinking about James Losh's acoustic fluidization mechanism or something. But anyway, some of them do definitely have devitrification textures and were definitely melts. The discussion about whether they are as abundant as we might expect centers around several things. One, how well would they be preserved in older rocks, because they will devitrify and they may not recognize them afterwards if they crystallize and recrystallize more coarsely. They're not actually that easy to see, even when they're, you know, when you know what you're looking for, you can see them. So a lot of geologists may have missed them, but the general consensus is that we should see more of them than we do, which consensus may be wrong, of course. Maybe they're there. So it's not quite clear whether, you know, most earthquakes produce this or not. One of the problems geologists and geophysicists have is looking at an old fault and saying, did this slip seismically or not? Because there's not much there that tells you how fast slip went on. You can, if you're lucky, you've got offset features and you can see how much slip there was, but how rapidly it took place is not very easy to do. And so pseudotachylites is, you can't produce something like a pseudotachylate if it occurs slowly, because the heat diffuses away too quickly and doesn't get hot enough to melt. So these are used by as evidence for paleo earthquakes, but how often they happen on earthquakes, we don't know.
These experiments on smooth or rough surfaces?
Relatively smooth. We'll see here, but
I expect it on a rough surface starts to melt and then falls into a crevice.
Right, well, we'll see. What happens is more dramatic than that, even. This is Toshi Shimamoto's one of his unconfined machine, the one he's got the most data on, really, in Kyoto. And so the sample is sitting right in here. This end is rotating. There's a clutch here, so you get this thing rotating, and then suddenly you pop the clutch. The normal stress is applied by an air actuator over here, and you measure the torque and normal stress over in this end. So when you pop the clutch, and I don't have one of these kind of nice videos of it, you get a radial volcano. I mean, you know, it starts glowing red, and then pretty soon melt starts kind of flying out in all directions at you here. It's really quite dramatic to watch. I first saw John Spray do this in his friction welding apparatus up in New Brunswick, and Toshi do it in his lab in Tokyo, and it's quite wonderful to see it happen. But clearly, because there's no confining pressure and it's a fairly small sample, the melt can escape. And it's also at fairly low normal stress, because at fairly high normal stress, the rock will just break up. So we'll come back to the issue of how much of a problem is that in the interpretation of the data. But they are fun experiments to do, that's for sure. So this is the first of two main papers they published on this. This was in 97. Log velocity versus coefficient of friction. So here's some of Jim Dietrich's data showing rate and state frictions. So this is the kind of the amount of weakening you get in the typical rate and state friction parameters. This is on gabbro, so this is granite. This is on gabbro. In these experiments with the open circles, there is no visible melting, and they are weaker than these, which had visible melting. Now, I don't know at what displacement. This is kind of a cross-section through data at various displacements. So, but we'll see in the next slide that if you look at friction in one experiment versus displacement, I think this is probably a range of experiments at different displacements, so I'm not exactly sure. But the thing that's interesting is that it seems to be stronger at a given velocity, although these are very steep falling off curves, it seems to be stronger at a given velocity if it melted than if it didn't melt. Well, Jim Rice has interpreted this as flash melting, although that wasn't initially suggested by Tutsimi and Shimamoto. And here is one sort of a typical experiment from the second paper that these guys have recently published. Here, friction versus displacement, relatively low normal stress, slipped up to 80 meters. The decay that eventually happens here occurs over about 15 meters of displacement. These numbers don't necessarily mean anything because the heat input rate here is pretty low because the normal stress is so low. And this is slipping not quite at a meter a second. They've got ones that go faster than this as well. So you get this initial weakening, and then it gets stronger, and then it gets weaker again. And these little inserts kind of show the interpretation. The idea is that this is flash melting, and it gets, you know, doesn't get all the way down to 0.4, but I mean to 0.2, but at least it's weakening. And then there's no microstructure to support this. Then in this region, if you stop an experiment in here, you'll find that there's little visible patches of melt covering a significant part of the surface. The idea being that it's getting stronger because this kind of viscous glue is starting to increase the real area of contact and offering some shear resistance. And then when it weakens again, the idea is you're finally getting a fairly through-going viscous layer, and it's weakening either due to the fact that it's thickening or due to the fact that you're pumping more viscous dissipation energy into it, and the temperature is going up, and so the viscosity is going down. So, but notice that the coefficient of friction here, which is really, of course, just the shear stress divided by this 1.25 normal stress, gives you a pretty high coefficient of friction. I mean, this is a Byerly's law of friction. This is not a weakening mechanism as seen through these data particularly. And if we go back to here, you know, maybe this is heading down to a lower value than that when you slide far enough. There's not tick marks on here. I guess there's a tick mark. So here's a meter a second. So it's not a very good weakening mechanism, but I think that may be affected by the fact that these are low normal stresses, which I'll address in a moment here. Let me get through these again. Okay, here's a picture. These are some experiments that Giulio De Toro from Padua University in Italy did in Toshi's lab within the last year or so. First of all, this is a pseudotacolite generated by Mother Nature in Giulio's field area up in the Alps. So this is a tonalite, which is a kind of like a granite. It's got feldspar and quartz and micas and stuff in it. So there's some cataclasite here, kind of ground up rock. But then there's this thin layer of pseudotachylite developed. And the experiments look kind of similar. You get cataclasite and you get this thin layer of pseudotachylite developed on the surfaces. So at least they managed to make things that look pretty much like real rocks. Now, one of the things that you often see in pseudotachylites, this is another picture from Julius Fulieri with an Italian coin for scale. Usually what you see is the so-called generation surface. This is the fault surface itself along which the melting has been caused by frictional heating. And then you see these veins that get injected off into the surrounding material. They often tend to be more on one side than the other. They often tend to have a certain orientation. And we'll see when we may or not see, but when Aristarchakis talks later this week, he may discuss a little bit the orientations of the stresses in some of their dynamic mode 2 fracture experiments. And the orientation of the least compressive stress tends to sort of be tilted in a certain orientation, and Giulio's tried to do some relations of that to the and the fact that they're more on one side or the other to say which direction this rupture may have propagated. And in any case, the melt kind of leaks off to some extent. So the loss into the veins is kind of similar to the radial loss flying out of the samples in these experiments. So at first blush, you might think, well, it's kind of similar. But on the other hand, in this case, the melt pressure can be pretty high if this is done by Mother Nature at some kind of depth. So if the resistance here is due to viscous shearing, although you get this melt loss, the melt pressure, if it's quite different, so if the resistance is due to viscosity, the viscosity isn't going to be that pressure dependent. And so the shear resistance is not going to be very pressure dependent. But if you did the same experiment at much higher normal stress, the apparent friction would be much lower because it would have about the same shear stress, much lower normal stress, and so it would seem to be a much better weakening mechanism than would seem to be the case by looking at that last data and saying that the coefficient of friction is only 0.6. So we're hoping to get to the point that we can do higher speed experiments in our confined rotary shear machine so we can study this mechanism where either the fluid isn't going to escape because it's kind of contained by our jackets, or at least the melt pressure is high, and as a consequence we have high normal stresses and therefore low coefficients of friction. So they've done in these ones in Tokyo, in Kyoto, they've done a little bit in the way of trying to change the normal stress, but they can't change it very much. And one of the things that they do is try to put a jacket of some kind around it, graphite jacket, I think, in when they try to go to somewhat higher pressures. But there's questions about whether the jacket is having some effect on the resistance. And we're going to have the same kind of problems. One of the difficulties of jacketing an experiment when you're sliding really fast and you've got something melted right next to it, right now we use Teflon, but we can't use Teflon. So we need kind of some refractory thing which is weak enough to kind of transmit the confining pressure into the rock, keep it strong enough that we can go to high normal stress, and yet to be weak enough that it can transmit the pressure and keep the rock intact, and yet isn't going to just be kind of totally wiped out by the high temperatures either generated by its own frictional self-heating by the frictional sliding of the jacket against itself, so it has to have a low coefficient of friction, or by the presence of this hot melt trying to escape through it. So these are not going to be trivial experiments, which kind of returns me to the point I was making at the beginning. Okay, the last mechanism I want to talk about is this lubrication by a thixotropic silica gel layer. David and I discovered this and then studied it more. This is a Nature paper on it in 2004. It involves generating a layer of silica gel by interacting with water with SiO2. And initially we did it in just quartz, but we've done it in other rocks, as we'll see. So the idea is that the shear strength of the gel is lowered by fast slip and large slip. It's a thixotropic material whose strength depends on competition between time-dependent strengthening and strain-dependent weakening, and we'll get back to that. But so we initially discovered it in experiments on quartz, but we found it in other rocks that have a fair amount of silica in them. And it could be important for earthquakes. We first thought it was just kind of an oddity in the lab, but the more I thought about it, the more I thought it might actually apply to real faults. But it may be hard to find field evidence for tiny amounts of gel, which may then later crystallize into quartz or whatever, and you don't know that they're there. So these were done in the same machine that we did these one-shot 90-degree rotation experiments, but here we slide back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And so we can slide long distances. In fact, we've slid up to about 60 meters or so in some experiments. We can't go quite as fast, it's less than 2/10 of a meter a second. I think it's really more. I think actually a 1/10 of a meter a second is as fast as we can go. I don't think this is quite right. And so what we see is this: if we're sliding, the displacement coefficient of friction, the displacement scale changes at this point where we change the speed and back at this point again. So sliding along at a slow speed, we get stick slip, coefficient of friction 0.7. Then we start going fast, 30 millimeters a second here. This is a micron a second. It decays and then kind of goes along like this. These oscillations in here are not actually oscillations. We are reversing the sliding direction every single time one of these little spikes occurs. And when it comes back up and goes back down again, there's some kind of there's some variability in the stress. So we've kind of rectified it all, so it's not negative. And in the next slide, you'll see what happens if we kind of just pick the data in the middle of each little oscillation period. But this is outlined in our Nature paper. And then, interestingly enough, when you slow down, it takes on the order of 300 seconds before it finally gets strong. And this happens whether you're sliding continuously or whether you're just sitting still and then start sliding. It seems to be a time constant, not a displacement. So it doesn't recover instantaneously its strength, unlike the flash melting mechanism. Plotted versus displacement coefficient of friction, again, these colors are 30 millimeters. These are at 100 millimeters a second. It's a little bit weaker at 100 millimeters a second. They both kind of decay down. But notice very interestingly, and I'm wondering whether this is some analogy with the melting layers we just talked about. Many of these weaken and then strengthen and then weaken again. So they all do that to some extent. They're all starting up at about here. So they all have some of this kind of thing. And it may be that there's some sort of local bits of gel first produced at asperity contacts or something. For a long time, we thought maybe this was melting, but it's not melting. It's just not hot enough to do that by calculations, by measurements we've made. So from the Nature paper, this shows that the coefficient of friction decays down a lot and would extrapolate to almost zero at a meter a second, whereas this is the kind of rate and state friction kind of rate. So this shows a possibility for big stress drops. We've tested the effect of humidity on this, because if it's due to silica gel, it shouldn't happen if there's no water in the system. So we surrounded the machine. Some undergraduates did this one summer with a bag and put dry nitrogen gas inside it. And here's a kind of a control experiment that got weak for room humidity. The dry one just stayed strong. They then opened a beaker of water inside the sample chamber, thinking that that would make it weak, and it didn't really weaken it much. Then at this point, where the color changes, they opened it to the atmosphere and just let it sit there in the humid Providence summer atmosphere. And after a while, and I forget, some of this happened overnight, so I'm a little not too clear about this. But anyway, eventually it got very weak, kind of the same weakness this would get to. Then they closed the bag up and put dry nitrogen in, and it got strong again. They opened it up again, and it got weak. So this seemed to be reversible. Now, we've not been able to repeat this experiment. And we've tried a few times. This grad student who tried, you know, maybe she didn't do things too carefully, but it's not obvious to us what's wrong. We can always make it weak, so that's not the issue. We can't seem to make it strong. I think we're not getting it dried out well enough somehow, but we don't understand why we're not getting it dried out well enough, because we're, you know, the water you have to have, the small humidity you have to have to make this be adequately dry is really hard to attain, as Jim Dietrich can attest to from some of his other kinds of experiments. So in some ways, I'm surprised the undergraduates managed to do as good a job as they did in getting this thing to work. And they're just smarter than we are, I guess, because we can't seem to repeat it. So, but it does at least, there's no way that they're going to fake this. I mean, it really happened. I just can't figure out why we can't reproduce it, which is why we haven't published this yet. It's clear that it was strong when it was dry, and that kind of goes together with it being a gel weakening. Now, if you look at the surfaces, this is 5 millimeters across here. This is one of our rings, and it's reflected light, so it's shining so brightly here that you can't see the kind of scratches, the radial scratches, the circumferential scratches here very well. So this is the surface of the nemaculite that's all kind of slid, and it's got these polished tops on them. And then there's these pits in the surfaces, which are due to the initial porosity. And if we zoom in with SEM and look at the margins of one of those pits, Here we see this mirror smooth surface. Over here in the bottom of the pit, we see the vacuolite that just didn't interact with the other side because it's in the bottom of the pit. But on the margins here, we see this material that looks like it's flowed. It seems to have been kind of troweled off of the surface by the sliding, kind of fell over the edges, and then apparently kind of froze up because it's now brittle, as you can see by the fractures in it. So I've got a couple more pictures of this. There's a little bit remnant of the mirror sliding surface up here, and all these kind of flow structures in this material we're attributing to silica gel. And so it just, you know, it's brittle now. We have measured the water content of this, and it's higher than that of quartz. There's a few percent water in it, which is kind of what you would expect for silica gel. There's wide amounts of water you can have in silica gel, and it can dry out in a time-dependent sort of way. So it's difficult to characterize it during the only way you can, in some ways, characterize it during the experiment is by the experiment itself, namely what's its frictional resistance. Okay, this shows what happens if you do various other rock types. We had an undergraduate from the University of Puerto Rico who worked with David one summer on this. And so here's the quartzite data we've already shown. Feldspar weakens in about the same way. A couple two feldspar experiments. Granite, I'm not sure how reproducible this is, but it seemed to be stronger, but it eventually weakens. Gabbro, however, notice, doesn't weaken at all. It's just, you know, about 0.8 over the whole velocity range. So if we plot at some particular velocity, at 100 millimeters a second, we plot the velocity versus silica content. Granite and the feldspar, pure feldspar rock, seem to have about the same amount of silica content, and they're about the same weakness. Quartz is a little bit weaker, gabbro stronger, calcite doesn't show it at all. So it seems like it takes a certain amount of silica to make this happen, which is one of the things we were testing for, and it kind of goes together with the idea of it being gel weakening. So the idea is that these gels, and independent, hadn't thought at all about silica gel, but as we look in the literature, we find that indeed there are particles with bonds between them that are disrupted by strain, and so in a thixotropic material in general, that is. So clays and paints tend to be thixotropic. It's often called shear thinning since the viscosity gets lower as the strain increases. The bonds become stronger with time if it just sits still, kind of sets up, basically. And so the strength is kind of a competition between the strain-induced weakening and the time-induced strengthening. And so we'd expect it to be weaker at higher velocity, time-dependent healing. That's what we observe. As far as we can tell, we've got this one nailed, and it really is due to silica gel. What its importance is in nature, you know, we still don't know. So what kind of friction do we get from these mechanisms?
Can I ask a really stupid question?
Sure. That's the best kind.
What's a silica gel? For the uninitiated.
Well, I'm a little uninitiated too, in spite of the fact I've tried to read a lot about it. It is SiO2 particles of some size or another. And what I mean by particle isn't entirely clear, whether I'm talking about almost the atomistic scale or, I mean, an opal is an example of a silica gel in which the little balls are all kind of the same size, and they're such the same size they diffract light. And these little balls, in the case of opal, consist of H2O and SiO2 somehow kind of together in some way. But I think they're also, to some extent, bonded together by the H2O. And I'm not, you know, the more the literature I've read on this, and there's quite a lot of it, it's just not all that clear about it. You read Eiler's book on silica, and it talks about all this stuff, and I still come away not having a very good feeling on what scale do we have SiO2 and water mixed together. It seems as though you can get almost a continuous range of water contents from a little bit of silica dissolved in an aqueous solution to almost all silica with a little bit of water dissolved in it, and a lot of ranges in between. So you can buy silica gel from the chemical companies and you can analyze and they'll say what their water content is. Most of the, and it's very hygroscopic. So when you buy a product and it's got a little bag in it to try to keep it dry, that's silica gel. It sucks up water like mad. So, but I, you know.
How are commercials or just normal silica gels, how are they made?
Well, there's a few different processes, and I had a slide which I took out that kind of addressed this a little bit. I mean, in some cases, they're made by essentially evaporating an emulsion or a solution of core of SiO2 in water, and gradually you get less and less water there, and but you don't get rid of all of it when they at the point where they stop somehow. And so it's amorphous silica, not crystalline. But what I don't have a good feeling for from anything I've read is on what scale is the SiO2 and the H2O kind of bonded to each other? Are the molecules right next to each other? Do you have a whole lot of like silica glass particles sitting here and another silica glass particle sitting in here with kind of water molecules kind of adsorbed on their surfaces and bonded to each other to hold it together? So
photographs look like a glass.
Yeah. I mean, when you get a bottle of silica gel, it's a white-looking powder. You know, it's not gel-like in the sense that you can kind of use it to put Brill cream on your hair or something. It doesn't seem very gel-like. It doesn't seem very viscous. But as I say, it seems to be thixotropic. And so I don't know. It's hard to study it because its water content is extremely time-dependent, environmentally dependent, temperature-dependent. I mean, another issue we have with how important this might be for nature is, you know, elevated temperature might kill this process off because it might drive off the water to the extent you couldn't have enough water to make a silica gel out of it. But silica gels are quite important in the geological production of lots of, you know, formations. I mean, the Monterey Formation and so forth, they often talk about it having lots of, essentially in that case, radiolaria shells of these little microorganisms, which are made out of silica, and it's kind of amorphous silica, and then it sits there and it kind of becomes a silica gel, and eventually they crystallize and become chert layers and stuff like that. So there's different kinds of, I don't know, that I've read a lot of stuff and I still don't have a very good understanding of exactly what it is, but I've shared my ignorance with you at least now. Yeah?
Sheer weakening thixotropic properties of silica gels should depend dramatically on the amount of water in it. So
yeah,
it should. Strong nanoproducibility of the experiment, because depending on a small variation in the amount of humidity or water dissolved, you should go from something which is a dry glass to something which is a colloidal glass with water, which has some rheology.
Well, it's interesting that in our experiments, at least, we pretty much are always getting this relatively around 0.2 coefficient. I mean, it seems to be relatively reproducible, more so than you would think based on the arguments you just gave, and I agree with you. So, I don't know. We've tried to think of ways of, you know, understanding more about its mechanical properties independent of the experiments themselves, but because it's clearly dehydrated quite a bit afterwards and it's brittle and it cracks and it's stronger, and we can see the 300 second time constant of its strengthening in the friction experiments, it's hard to figure out how to measure its properties out of the experiment, and so the thixotropic character of it makes it very tricky. So this is just to kind of summarize that we really don't know very well what the importance of some of these mechanisms or what kind of how to think about a coefficient of friction from them. The pore fluid pressure one can go all the way from 0 to 0.6 depending on how much slip there is, and the pore pressure just gradually goes up and up according to Rice's calculations. But some of these other mechanisms, I mean, this may be a lot less than this because, as I say, at higher normal stress it might appear to have a much lower coefficient of friction. These are both fairly low, and they could be, you know, this one doesn't seem to get much lower than this, but this one might go down to 0. So we don't know. Well, I think I should quit at this point. I've already been talking I'm happy to keep talking, but you guys probably want to have lunch. What I put into the back of here is just a bunch of stuff about the implications of this having to do with stress drops. And I don't know whether Jim Rice or Nadia Lapusta has talked about some of these kind of results before, so I don't know what you've all heard. And, you know, I figure that, well, I'm happy to go through this, but I have a feeling that maybe this is not the appropriate time to do it. So I'm at your pleasure as to whether we quit for lunch. I suspect that's probably what we should do.
Can I just ask a question?
Pardon?
Can I just ask a question?
Of course.
Suppose I'm only interested of knowing, predicting when earthquakes will occur. Is it all these things irrelevant? I mean, then we also the friction just at the beginning when the slide
right.
is very, very low. It's not a question about meter per second, it's a question about
yeah.
I don't know what meter per second, whatever. And now you have a different friction load.
Yeah. My presumption is that this kind of stuff I've been talking about today is important for trying to understand the nature of the strong ground motions that occur during the earthquake after it's underway. And they could have some pretty important ramifications for how strong can the strong motion be and so forth. But as far as the initiation process, it's Jim Dietrich's rate and state friction that I think is really important. And sometimes when I send in research proposals, people say, well, you know, why are you still trying to understand the origin of the evolution effect, the state of evolution effect in rate and state friction? Because, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with damaging earthquake motions. Well, it may have something to do with earthquake prediction, and that's kind of where a lot of my interest still lies. So I think that we really need to understand, earthquake prediction, we need to understand these nonlinear processes that go on in the accelerating phase leading up to the start of dynamic rupture, at which point what I've been talking about today starts kicking in. And there's been a lot more experimental work on trying to understand rate and state friction. Some of what David Goldsby talked about last week sort of has, you know, is related to that. And I still think that's really important. And in fact, a lot of the computer modeling I'm doing, trying to predict earthquakes and get a model that has little earthquakes and try to figure out when they grow into big ones and so forth, is all kind of tied up with this nucleation phase and the role that rate and state friction may play on that. On the other hand, the high-speed slip and how much slip there is and how big the stress drops are sort of set the stage for the next earthquake, and so may have some influence on the kind of initial conditions for leading up to the next one and the predictability of that. So it's not totally irrelevant, but it's not the... If you were really trying to understand earthquake prediction, you'd probably ignore everything I said today and think more about what David talked about last week.
In terms of the inner event times we were talking about last week, maybe?
A little bit by a stress concentration at the tip of the running crack. So the stress drop is low, is very large. You'd expect, you know, large accelerations. These are probably larger stress drops than we observe. And so until we, you know, when we thought dynamic friction might just be up here someplace, we didn't have a problem. But now if we think dynamic friction is down here, we have a problem. So the kind of calculations that Nadia Lapusta and Jim Rice have been doing, so they put the initial stress much lower. Most of it is overcome by stress concentration at the tip of the running crack. And then dynamic friction comes out in their modeling from the flash heating and from the fluid thermal pressurization mechanism. And they've shown that you can indeed overcome the static friction by the stress concentration at the tip of the propagating rupture. And then you have no problem. The stress drops will work fine. You don't have much, as Nadia showed, the static strength is up here, but it's overcome. Locally, it has to be overcome at the nucleation point by high stress concentrations or something. But once the earthquake starts, then most of the, you know, you've got these events that go on, so the stress goes up, and then in a given region, it propagates through to this region by the rupture coming through. And so all the slip is going on while the stress is really very low, and so there's not much heat generation. Everything is fine. This works perfectly, except if the in-situ stress measurement, say the stress is mostly way up here, then we got a problem. So I used to like the fact that in situ stress measurements agreed with laboratory friction values, because everybody was questioning the value of laboratory friction values. Now I'm concerned about that they seem to be, say that the strength of the crust is, stresses in the crust are stronger than they would like to be to make this understood. So it's kind of a dilemma, it seems to me. Jim?
I was just going to add that the dilemma intensifies a little too when you consider various micro earthquakes. So some of these weakening mechanisms you discussed, in a micro earthquake, the slip may only be a millimeter or a fraction of a millimeter, actually.
It's all very confusing. I mean, the flash heating mechanism would weaken that somewhat, but I don't know that we have, as far as I know, there's not much data suggesting a systematic change in stress drops between microearthquakes and bigger ones, although, generally speaking, the smaller the earthquake, the bigger stress drop often tends to be, because I think the big ones kind of average areas with high stress and with low stress, but anyway. Yeah, so that's, I'm sorry I talked so long. I thought, 40 minutes, well, been a discussion, I can fit all this in, but with a discussion it takes a long time. So thanks very much.